All right, so session 17. And we just came off last week where we were talking about language and basically the development of writing, the evolution toward an alphabet, and all of those, to me, fascinating, egg-headed things, but also always with an eye toward how the language was also shaping the development of the Bible. I mean, this is the whole reason we're going through this stuff. It's not in isolation, even though for me it's a great story and I could just enjoy it. But always with an eye toward how it affected the development, composition, transmission of the Bible. And so we talked about that, how the development of the alphabet was going hand in glove with the development of the Bible. And the Bible was old enough that it was being written as language was evolving, which is kind of a fascinating thing. And then we talked about how now, because we know that, and that we can see the footprints of this evolution of language in the various manuscripts that we still have in existence, it gives us clues into the timing, the dating of the writing and the authorship, the type of peoples who would have been involved, so on and so forth. I mean, this has a lot of bearing sometimes on the way that scholars will be using that text, again, to chase that holy grail of the original text. I mean, that's what they're trying to get back to. We want to know what that original text was. And since we don't have any of the autographs, it is a difficult moving target. But all these things are giving us clues. So tonight what we want to do is we want to take a look at the actual writing materials that were used. And if you have your textbooks, you can go to page 89. And I'm going to read a few passages here, but don't worry if you don't. You can just listen. The development of writing is also contemporaneous, I guess is the word, with the development of the Bible. So as the Bible is being developed, the writing tools, the writing materials are also developing and evolving through time. So if you go all the way back to the earliest forms of writing, what were people writing on? Well, it was stone. You know? And if you think about it, the Bible reflects this because what Moses was writing on and what God actually is credited with writing on Mount Sinai was stone tablets. And so God writes the first version, you know, the dot one version. Moses goes down the mountain, breaks them, and then has to go up and do dot two himself. So V2. But it's writing on stone. And then there are other, in Job 19:24, here in that last paragraph on page 89, Moses receiving the stone tablets. Job 19:24 also referring to an iron instrument or implement being used to scrape, inscribe a piece of stone. And then we have Deuteronomy 27 that states that stones were to be covered with lime, and then the words of the law were to be written on them. Perhaps the lime provided an easier surface to chisel, and more likely it provided a suitable background on which the letters could be drawn. And so we see stone as one of the earliest writing surfaces. Obviously it was natural, it was native, and it could be easily procured, and so it was chiseled into. Now the advantages of stone is it's permanent. You do it, it lasts practically forever unless there's something really eroding the surface of the stone. On the downside, it's big, it's heavy, it's bulky, and if you're going to try to do something that was very long, you needed walls, temple walls or something to do it. But it wasn't movable. So what's the next possible evolution? It'd be going to clay. Because clay hardens into something like stone and becomes permanent, but as in its soft form, it's much more pliable, malleable, and you don't have to chisel it, so it's a lot easier to work with. And so clay tablets, now on page 91, another durable writing material. And if you do have your books, there's some samples there, some pictures of some clay tablets that have now been found. The clay tablets were the basic writing material of the Sumerians who invented the cuneiform script that we talked about last time. And the cuneiform script was made with a stylus just pressed into the clay. And so when you have this wedge-shaped stylus, that's your footprint. So everything has to be straight lines, and they developed this very complex system with hundreds and hundreds of characters. Because remember, it was a pictographic or logographic form of writing. So it wasn't an alphabet. So each one of those symbols was denoting either a syllable or a concept, which means you need a lot of them. It's not until you develop a true alphabet for each symbol or sign is simply signifying a sound that we can make with our vocal apparatus. Now you can get down to just 22, 26, 27 signs. And we talked about the Chinese system that has over 10,000 signs to it, and the Japanese system, which they have now worked down to about 1,800, and 800 of those have to be taught to school children, which is one reason they have this transliterated form of Japanese that can be used with the same alphabet that we use, because it's much simpler. Literally, it's interchangeable. I mean, once you have a language, a spoken language, you can denote that language in any alphabet. As long as you assign letters to the sounds, it can be written. And you can see that these alphabets have been interchanged. So the Phoenician alphabet that was finally developed in the Near East was then borrowed by the Greeks and borrowed by other civilizations, and eventually by the Romans, and now by us, because we're using that Roman alphabet. So the languages are developing, the alphabet is developing, the writing materials are developing. So with clay tablets now, we have something that's much easier to deal with, hardens and becomes durable like stone, but once it is hardened, you get the same problems you have with stone. It's big and it's bulky, and how do you do longer works? Well, if you're on page 92, you can see that one of the ways that you did longer works was to do them on barrels, big cylinders or barrels. And what they would do, they would create these clay barrels, and they drill a hole through it or do it around a dowel so that the thing literally was suspended on a stand, and you would turn the thing in order to read it. Mm-hmm. Okay. So this is one way that longer works, and a couple pages back, there is the Code of Hammurabi, which was found in 1901, and this is on a conical shaped, almost like an obelisk looking thing, but it would be wrapping around that this is stone rather than clay. But you get the idea. In order to do longer works, it was still very difficult to deal with. Pottery shards, we talked about that before. So pottery that was made and shaped and fired often was decorated, painted. What happens when you break the pot? Not much good for anything, except all those little shards can then be used like scrap paper, like note paper. And so they would collect those and they would keep those. So people who were practicing their letters, or often they were used to denote business transactions or whatever. So pottery shards became another type of writing material. Did you have a question?
Okay,
post-it. Post-its, exactly. Just like post-its.
Except a lot lighter. Mm-hmm. Well, post-its are a lot lighter.
And so these become really important to archaeologists. They get all excited when they see broken pots in the bottom of the pit. Mm-hmm. When we see trash, they're seeing windows into that civilization. And so pottery shards, another important form of writing material. Then we get to papyrus, and papyrus is a major step in a different direction. And I did give you one sheet, if you look at that first sheet there. And I'm going to read, if you have your books on page 92, y'all have just 93, but I'm going to read a little bit before we get to the page that you have, because this is stated about as well as it can be stated to understand what papyrus is all about. It's a reed plant that grows in swamps along the Nile River. The pith of the reed was cut into strips about 12 to 15 inches long and laid in two layers, alternated horizontally and vertically. So you've got that figure 620 there that's illustrating that. The sheets were left to dry on a flat surface with a weight on top, causing the natural sugar in the plant to bind the layers together. Okay? So you got a round stalk, and I know some of you don't see it, but these are what the plants actually look like, with that little bottle brush kind of top on it. And they would take the stalks and then slice them vertically into these strips. But they're wet, and they've got these sugars in them, so when you lay them on top of each other, they bind together. And so they didn't have to use any adhesive or anything. The strips on the front, the recto of the papyrus, ran horizontally, and those on the back, the torso side, ran vertically. The front was generally the only side written on because it was smoother. The Hebrew word for this marsh plant is most likely gome, and there's several, Exodus, Job, and Isaiah have citations of where that word occurs, which is sometimes translated in the Greek of the Septuagint is papyrus, and the Latin spelling is papyrus, and is related to the English word paper. A single piece of papyrus in Greek is called a kartes, which is translated paper in 2 John 12, and it appears that as early as the 3rd millennium B.C., okay, that's 5,000 years ago, papyrus was used for writing. An Egyptian story from about 1090 B.C. records that a man named Wen Amon traded the Phoenicians papyrus for wood. And there are other Herodotus states, 5th century and so on and so forth. Papyrus was significantly more convenient than clay tablets since it could be easily written upon, was very light, and could be joined together in scrolls or codices, which is plural for codex. That's the book. Okay, so just bound along the edge as we would do it. But remember, it's only written on one side because the back side is pretty rough. And then you've got a picture there on figure 6.1 of an actual papyrus fragment. And this is from the Rylands Library, a papyrus fragment from the Gospel of John, 18:31-33, dated to the early 2nd century, possibly only about 50 years after it was written. But this fragment, when they say after it was written, they mean after the autograph was written. Okay? The fragment was acquired in 1920 in Egypt and is located in the John Rylands Library in Manchester, England. Remember when we were talking about there's somewhere in the neighborhood of 24,000 witnesses and manuscripts. This would be one of those witnesses. But you can see it's just a fragment. This was found someplace, you know, probably amid a pile of broken fragments and just papyrus dust. But this one fragment survived enough for them to be able to read it. And it just contains these few precious verses, just a couple of verses. But this would be one of those witnesses. So you can see when we talk about 24,000 manuscripts, we're not talking about full Bibles by any stretch, or full books for that matter. There are just fragments. And most of the books that date back appreciably into history are full of what are called lacuna, which are missing pieces, parts of the fragment that have been either lost, broken out, discolored to the point that you can't read. And so there's just pieces missing. So what scholars do, they read what they can read, and then they compare that to other things and mix and match and try to come up again, trying to get back to that original text. But I wanted to stress that a lot of these witnesses, these manuscripts, are just little tiny pieces like that. And let's see. Okay, so it could be joined in scrolls or codices books and was easily handled. However, there were some drawbacks to using papyrus. It was not nearly as durable as clay tablets. It was not readily available outside of Egypt. Its surface was rough. It was susceptible to damage from water and light, and age caused it to become brittle and crumble into powder. The first modern discovery of ancient papyrus documents was in 1778 when some Egyptians found a jar containing 40 to 50 documents. Since no one would buy them, they burned all but one. Don't you just love when that happens? Papyrus documents have been found only in dry climates such as Egypt and the Sinai Desert, the Dead Sea area, and in the volcanic ash of Herculanarium. To date, the oldest known New Testament papyrus document contains a few verses from John 18 and is generally dated to about AD 125. So that's getting pretty far back there, 125. Concerning biblical papyrus documents versus clay records, Bruce observes, so while we can read the original inscriptions of the Assyrian and Babylonian kings and the notes which common people wrote on pieces of pottery in 8th century Samaria and 6th century Lachish, the autographs of the Hebrew prophets who were their contemporaries have disappeared long ago, as also have the autographs of all the other biblical writers, most probably all of whom wrote on papyrus. So because they wrote on papyrus, so few of the records survive. And the ones that do survive from the earliest dates are in those really dry climates because the moisture didn't get at the reeds and rot them away. So again, the oldest documents that we have that are most recently found, that Alexandrian textual family that we keep coming back to, comes from those areas, those dry areas, where the papyrus actually had a chance to survive. Now we can move on to leather. And leather was usually obtained from the hides of sheep, goats, antelope, and other similar animals. It was dried, shaved, and scraped clean for writing. Leather was more durable than papyrus, and yet still dries out, cracks, and finally crumbles away. In Egypt, there are references to documents written on skins in the time of the 4th dynasty, which would be 2900 to 2750 BC. And the actual specimens are extant from the 12th dynasty, 2000 to 1788 BC. More important for our present purpose is the traditional use of leather for the books of the law in Hebrew. In the Talmud, it is laid down that all copies of the law used in public worship must be written on skins of clean animals. Mm-hmm. All right? No pigskin here, guys. And it's in roll form, so it's always in scroll form. Yeah?
What does the word extant mean?
Still in existence.
Thank you. You are extant, my friend.
A good share
at least
of the
so
scrolls,
far.
A good share of the scrolls found at Qumran, those are Dead Sea Scrolls, were made of leather, and one of the most important was the Isaiah scroll. That was a huge find. If the letter of Aristes, a 2nd century BC, can be trusted, the original scrolls of the Hebrew Old Testament, which the translators of the Septuagint copied, were also made of leather. Okay, so leather is the next in line of materials. And you see how we're moving toward materials that were most readily available to now we're getting more and more refined as we go, right? And so the next refinement of leather is into parchment. All right, so parchment is also made from the skins of animals such as sheep, calves, goats, and antelope. The skins are soaked in lime water to make them white. Okay, so bleaching them out with the lime water makes them whiter. Bruce Metzger notes, the younger the animal, the finer was the quality of the skin. Why?
It's new.
So it's more elastic.
Yeah. Smoother. You know, it doesn't have any of the, I don't know, the animals have pores too, I guess. Whatever they've got that makes it rougher.
So. Actually, animals don't have pores. Isn't that why they don't?
Yeah, but they fall on rocks and they get scarred and hide.
Now, the finest of the parchment was called vellum. And vellum was the finest quality of extra thin parchment, sometimes obtained from animals not yet born. So now we're going into fetal skin in order to get the very finest skin. Yes?
Today, when they say parchment, it's fine paper, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And vellum is, so it's changed. I never knew that parchment was originally made from skin.
Yes. And it was scraped extra fine, extra thin. And I almost got to the point where it was translucent. You could kind of see through it. But yes, and the original Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, was written on parchment.
You know, parchment
real
meaning?
Real parchment, skin.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so, yes,
there's
you're right.
Every day.
If you say parchment and vellum now, you're talking about very, very fine paper.
Yes,
that
I
still
know.
Has some of the qualities of parchment and has that look to it. But as far as I know, pita without a cow. That's kind of a
bad saying, isn't it?
Pita would be very upset if there's so many.
That's an oxymoron, isn't it?
Yeah, that was that handmade parchment. But in just fine paper stores, you can get parchment that's still not skin. But yes, they were making actual. She's talking about this show that we saw where they were making.
Jobs.
Yeah. But they were making actual parchment from animal skins in a little mom and pop shop. A couple that was doing this, but it was fascinating to watch the process. Because they went right from getting the skins with all the fur on them and everything from the slaughterhouses or whatever sources they used, and then tanning them and soaking them, and then getting to the point where they could scrape all the hair off, and then they stretched them on these big frames, so they were stretched out tight, and then they continued to scrape and scrape and scrape, and it was a long, long process that they finally got to the point where it was of the right
amazing. Thickness, I didn't know that.
And all of this. And it was dried out, and then they would cut it and create.
So the Constitution was, you said that was written on parchment, the real parchment. Mm-hmm. So in that time, they had tanneries that would give parchment?
Sure, absolutely.
Well, I flunked that great.
So the younger animal, the finer the quality of the skin, vellum, the finest quality of extra thin parchment, sometimes obtained from animals not yet born. Parchment was more expensive than papyrus, but it had several advantages. It is smooth and durable. Both sides could be written on. The light color gave clarity to the writing, and parchment could be reused because you could just re-scrape it. And there's a word that you've probably never heard before. It's a palimpsest. Have you ever heard that? No. Palimpsest. It's a French word, and it simply means reuse. When we find a palimpsest, basically, scholars are able sometimes to be able to read what was underneath the second text. Very important. And they're able to use different wavelengths of light. You've probably seen that on CSI or some of these other shows, where they can use different wavelengths of light to look at different depths within the skin or the parchment or the melon or whatever they're using to be able to read what was underneath, similar to what they're able to do now to look underneath a painting, a canvas that has been painted over, and they can look underneath and see. And so the palimpsest is somewhere where we can see that there is text underneath. But according to Galen, a famous Greek physician of the second century, it had the drawback of being shiny and thus put more strain on the eyes than did papyrus. The word parchment is derived from the name Pergamum. And you'll probably all know that from the book of Revelation, right? Mm-hmm. The Church of Pergamum, a city of Asia Minor that became important as a center of parchment production. Use of parchment in the production of books became widespread in the 2nd century B.C., and because of its durability, parchment became the preferred writing material for the scriptures. And often parchment was lined or scored before being used for writing, just like, you know, your school paper, right? As samples from the Qumran show. Early Greeks wrote on parchment or papyrus with reeds that had been dried, sharpened to a point, and then split in the middle of the point to hold ink or frayed and used like a brush. Exactly like our fountain pens of today, right? And then obviously later on it was feather quills that were also cut on an angle and then split down the middle to hold the ink. Beyond that, wooden or ivory tablets, and if you've got your books, there's a picture here of these. They were joined in a Z pattern of hinges so they could be folded up like this. And I know that's kind of hard to see. It's not much of a picture there. But these wooden tablets or ivory tablets were then covered with either wax or what was the other? There was another substance. Let's see. Flat or wood ivory tablet covered with a thin, smooth layer of plaster or wax, and was used as temporary messages. So these are truly your post-it notes here. So they take this piece of ivory or piece of wood, cover it with a thin layer of plaster or wax. You could write in it, and then you could simply just scrape back over the plaster and write again, or with the same thing with the wax. You take a hot piece of metal and just remelt it and smooth out the surface, and you're good to go again. So that would be perfect for practicing school children or leaving notes or that stuff, or doing additions within the business community, that sort of thing. And then when you needed to go on to the next day's business, you just erase the board and start over again. These writing boards were generally hinged to form what they call a diptych, that would be two, or polyptych, which would be more that accordion style that could be easily closed and stored. And then finally, precious metals were also used. And a couple of the scrolls from Qumran were written. The copper scroll is one of the famous ones. So you take the metal and hammer it out flat, and then you could actually write in it. So several different types of precious metals were used as writing materials. Gold, silver, copper, bronze, iron. A copper scroll found in Cave 3 of Qumran bears the list of treasures and where it was supposedly hidden. And if you don't think that didn't cause some excitement, I think they're still looking for them. There was a silver amulet also in the mid-7th century B.C., which would rank them to the oldest biblical text found to date. And then finally, we get to paper. Paper, the writing material with which we are most familiar, was introduced from Central Asia to Egypt about A.D. 900. Okay, so we're almost 1,000 years after the time of Christ. So it's really important to realize that all through the writing of the Bible, the development and transmission of the Bible for about almost 1,000 years, we're talking about all these other materials. Because paper was unknown in Europe and the Roman world until that time. So in China and Central Asia, they were experimenting with paper, but it wasn't until then that the trade routes were opened and these materials started to come to Europe. Paper was made by dipping a screen into a mixture of cotton fibers and water. The cotton mixture trapped on the screen was then turned out into a mat, pressed to expunge excess water, and left to dry from 1 to 4 days. So can you picture that? basically you've got this paste almost, and you get a screen in there and you get the screen all flat, turn it over, pound it down, let it dry, and what's left. If you've ever seen handmade paper, this is what we're talking about it would look like. Not this kind of paper here. It wouldn't have that kind of feel. Handmade paper is really beautiful if you've seen it. But it almost looks more like dryer lint. You know, it's got that sort of look to it, you know, that heavy rag of the cotton or the edges. So handmade paper would look a lot like what they're talking about. Paper coupled with the emergence of movable print enabled books to be printed cheaply and quickly. The first printed Bible, the Gutenberg Bible, was produced in 1452 using a combination of parchment and paper. So if you kind of see where this is going, Gutenberg finally invented the printing press and movable type. He wasn't the absolute first one to do it. Again, back in Asia, there were experiments with movable type and experiments with the printing press. But Gutenberg is the one who's quite credited with it, at least in the West. But in 1440, he perfects this thing. And at the same time, you know, paper has now been introduced into Europe about the same time. And coincidence? You know, you tell me. We have paper now in Europe. We have the invention of the printing press, and only just a few more than, was it 13 years later, the emperor of Byzantium, or the Byzantine Empire, falls to the Ottoman Turks. And Europe gets flooded with all of these scholars from the East bringing their Greek Bibles with them. There's this huge confluence of events, you see. And not only that, it's the Renaissance is just kicking off. Because the trade routes are open now. And so we're coming out of the Dark Ages. The people are starting to understand that, you know, the church has been holding on to the scriptures. And for several hundred years now, individuals have been trying to start to translate the Latin Bible into the local vernacular. But there was no way to mass produce it because everything had to be hand copied with these difficult materials. And so everything starts to come to a point where not only do we have suddenly paper, we've got movable type, we've got a population that is finally ready to break free from the stranglehold of the Roman Church, and then we get an influx of scholars from the East bringing Greek texts that were really unknown in Western Europe, that only knew the Vulgate, the Latin version. And all this stuff kind of comes to a head and explodes across Europe. And so it's just only 100 years later that you've got Martin Luther banging his 93 theses to the door of the Wittenberg Castle, and the beginning of the Reformation takes off from there. So you can kind of see how all of this stuff works together in this fascinating sort of way. And the Bible is right there every step of the way. And we're going to see now as we move further on how all this starts to come together. Go ahead and turn the page. And we've got this biblical languages. My chicken scroll there. Remember that we talked about Hebrew and Aramaic being sister languages, right? Yes. If you think about Abram being called out, first of it's his father Terah, who is called out of Ur of the Chaldees and moves with his whole tribe up to what would be now either northern Iraq or Syria, at the northwest end of the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. And in an area called Haran at that time, Haran, I suppose would be the right way to pronounce it, bringing with them their language of that area. No one really knows where Ur would be located. The most likely place is right at the headwaters of the Tigris and Euphrates, right at the end of the Persian Gulf, right there near the coastline. And so they probably traveled up, if you're looking at it this way, it would go this way, through the Tigris-Euphrates Valley, and they settled up here in the northwest. And then from there, Abram goes straight south into Canaan. So whatever language they spoke, now being geographically removed from the region in which it was born, it starts to mutate and change and take on its own characteristics as living languages do. So Hebrew literally means cross, to cross over. And so the Hebrews are the ones who crossed over. They crossed over the desert, they crossed over from another area, and the language that they brought with them evolved into Hebrew. Well, what was the original language that was spoken? Was it Aramaic? Could have been. Or it could have been some other tongue. Aram was the son of Shem, who was the son of Noah. So Aram is only two generations from Noah after the flood, and Aram as a geographical location is also in that same area of Syria and northern Iraq, traditionally. And so was that a separate language? And they too had a mother tongue that they devolved from. Did Hebrew evolve out of Aramaic? Nobody really knows. But what we do know is that they're very closely related. They use the same alphabet, the same sort of root and pattern system, and most importantly, they share the same conceptual framework. And so they said translating from Hebrew to Aramaic can be done without any loss. And when you go to a Western language like Greek, that you get loss in terms of the understanding of the language. So we've got this these languages, and if you look at this tree here, what I've tried to draw for you is kind of the family tree of biblical languages. And so we've got time running from top to bottom along that left-hand column from about 2000 BCE down to the present. And Hebrew, Aramaic, Greek, Latin, and English, okay, are kind of splayed across the spectrum here. Let's go down the Hebrew column and just take a look at what's happening. So somewhere possibly as early as 2000 BC, or maybe as late as 1400 to 1300 BC, depending on where you want to date the earliest books of the Bible, those Old Testament autographs are being written not only in Hebrew, but also in Aramaic. All right? So we have from, say, 2000 to somewhere, oh gosh, in that first century BC, before Jesus comes on the scene, we have the Old Testament autographs being written. They're actually being compiled and composed. And then, through the New Testament time, there is no active writing of any of the biblical manuscripts. And after the fall of the temple, around 90 CE, the Council of Yavne closes the canon and kind of sets it in stone, chooses which books are in and which books are out. And part of what they took out was the Apocrypha.
Yeah. What are the vertical columns? I don't know if there's supposed to be headers up here, but in other words...
Uh-oh, did something get cut off?
Yeah, there's no headers.
Oh, good grief.
So the first thing...
Everybody, if you got a pen, I'm sorry. How's that happen? The top, it should, the very top header should have just been biblical languages. So if you put that at the very top, all the way at the top.
It's like BC. Mm-hmm.
I was having lots of trouble with my copy of today. So. Did you get any of these?
No, I'll get
them. Okay, where it's, the first column where it says Old Testament autographs by Hebrew. I was wondering why you were looking quizzically at it. The second column, right over where Old Testament autographs and also Targums write Aramaic.
I fell in.
A-R-A-M-A-I-C. Over the column that starts with Septuagint, write Greek. Over the column that says Old Latin and Various, write Latin. And the last column is English. Okay. All right, I think that's... Let me see if that's... Is anything else that's cut off? All right, everything else looks good. Okay, so... Old Testament autographs being written, Council of Yavne closes it, and then what you've got starting around 500 CE is this group of Jewish scholars called the Masoretes, and they are taking and they're adding vowel points and revising the language, trying to standardize the text and standardize the production of the Bible. They do it so well that everything else kind of falls into disuse. And the Bible that is used today is the Masoretic text. So the Hebrew text that is being used today is this direct line. So right to the present, the Masoretic text is the one that's being used in Judaism. Okay. Now, let's move over one column. Aramaic. Part of the Bible is written in Hebrew. Part of the Old Testament is written in Hebrew. Part of it is written in Aramaic. The Targums were a translation from Hebrew to Aramaic that Ezra is credited with either doing or at least starting. And this would be after the Jews returned from exile, from Babylon. At this point, there are so many Jews who don't read, write, understand Hebrew anymore that the text has to be translated. And the Targums consist of not only a translation of the text itself, but also commentaries on the text. Then when we move into New Testament times, you have part of the debate going on here. I have NT autographs starting around, you know, somewhere after the crucifixion, after 30 CE, with a question mark after it. Because Eastern scholars will say that the New Testament books were written first in Aramaic and then translated into Greek, and of course Western scholars say the exact opposite, that the books were written first in Greek and then translated into Aramaic. And so I'm kind of personally coming down on the side that it was first written in Greek, with the possible exception of Matthew, Mark, maybe James, there's a couple others that are so Hebrew in character, so Semitic in character, that it's possibly went the other way around.
Why would you take that stance when everything is coming from Hebrew to Aramaic? I mean, why would you? I mean, it seems to, it would follow the line that they would be scrolling something down.
It's because linguistically and in terms of the actual copies that we have, it seems from the reports that I've read and the work of the scholars, much more likely linguistically that it went from Greek to Aramaic and not the other way around. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But as I've said, I think in here before, it doesn't really matter to me so much which one of the copies came first. Because regardless of whether the books we have in the New Testament were written first in Greek or Aramaic, they were first spoken in Aramaic.
Oh, that's
me
right. I'm confused.
So the original thought forms, as Jesus expressed them to his contemporaries, were in Hebrew Aramaic. And they existed in oral tradition. They existed in various records and written forms and bits and pieces until they are finally compiled maybe 100 years later, but certainly at least 50 to 70 years after the crucifixion. So if they were first compiled in Greek, they were still being translated at least out of Aramaic forms just from the oral tradition, from the interviews that these writers and compilers had with eyewitnesses or whomever they were getting their records from. So either way, it was a translation from that thought form into Greek. It's just we may not have any of the intermediate forms anymore. And it may be possible that they were never fully written down. The Gospel of Mark, as it exists today, may never have been written down in Aramaic before it was written in Greek, but it came from Aramaic and Hebrew sources. Although Mark has the most transliterations of Aramaic in it than any other Gospel. So it's quite possible that it was written in Aramaic first and translated to Greek, and they left a lot of those words and phrases untranslated. But Mark has more than any other Gospel.
One other question. And you said we can distinguish between, because Aramaic is concise, one more, you know, where the Greek had a tendency to use a lot of, I don't know, verbs, adverbs or whatever. I'm using the wrong term. But trying to
relate
to you.
No, I don't think I was saying that so much as I was saying that Hebrew and Aramaic, especially ancient Hebrew and Aramaic, had very small vocabularies.
Okay, so
as opposed to Greek, which had a large, specific vocabulary. So Hebrew and Aramaic had few words with lots of simultaneous meanings, whereas Greek is much more specific and has basically a word for each thing and less simultaneous meaning, just like English does.
Why?
English
but
is
I'm
like
confused.
Greek on steroids, basically.
I'm sorry, I'm confused because I thought we could tell the difference between, if we're reading a script that has all these, the spluff, it would be Greek. And if it was just go here to the store, that would be Aramaic or Hebrew. No, and this would go hinder around the corner, yon under. You know what I'm saying? And both saying the same thing. One being Greek, one being Aramaic.
What you're talking about are the textual families.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Byzantine textual family. That's where, if in a geographical area, a text stayed in the vernacular, that is the language of the people, for a longer period of time, what it tended to do was pick up more and more words.
Oh, I understand.
Right? But in, for instance, in Egypt, where it changed from Greek to Arabic when the Muslims came through and conquered the area, and Greek stopped being used as vernacular, then any Greek text we find was stopped at a point in time and a very long time ago, at least 6th, 7th century. And so those are like snapshots. They're like time capsules.
Oh, I
and
understand.
So that's why they're shorter. Like one school of thought says, that's why they're shorter, because they didn't have all of those centuries to pick up more and more words. As things are copied over and over again, they tend to get longer. That's just human nature, all right? So I think that's what you're
That's exactly what I was thinking. Yeah. I'm sorry. That's
not the same thing that we're talking about
okay.
here.
Okay, I'm sorry I took time out.
That's okay. That's what we're here for.
Well, that's a good one.
What's that? Oh, Bill.
For those of us who learn things by seeing pictures, mm-hmm. like moi,
yeah.
will you give an analogy of how it would change if it went from English back to Aramaic? I can't see that in my brain.
If it went from English back to Aramaic?
Yeah. What would happen? Give us a word picture.
If you were translated from English back to Aramaic?
Yes.
Or from Greek back to Aramaic?
Yes.
All right. Let's say we have one word in Greek that means a specific thing. Let me go the other way. Let's say that we have a word like love. And in Greek, there are five different words that mean love. They all mean a slightly different type of love. But there are five different words that mean love. In Aramaic, there are two that I know of. And they're slightly different. So if we're translating from Greek to Aramaic, the likelihood of us finding the right word is going to be a lot mathematically greater than if we're translating from Aramaic into Greek. Right? You got more targets to hit in Greek. You got fewer targets to hit in Aramaic. In Aramaic, they didn't... You put a different word for each different type of thing, typically. What they did was pile on the meanings on top of one another, and you distinguish the meaning in context, in the context of the phrase or whatever was going around it. You knew pretty much which one they were using. So even if the Greek gospel was written first and translated back to Aramaic, the chances are that they got the right word is greater than if we were going in the other direction.
Oh.
So does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
So the word, a person talking in Aramaic has a genuine brotherly love for someone. I think that one is phileo, if I'm not mistaken.
In Greek.
So they, Bill, I love you. In Greek, I would say, hey, man, I phileo you. In Aramaic, if I was attracted to you, I would say, Marin, I eros you.
No,
how did they
that's
split?
Greek, too.
That's Greek.
You would probably say rahem.
Well, if there's only one word for love in Aramaic, how do I tell him I love you and tell you I love you? And you know I mean it, sexually, and you know I mean it as my friend. How did they do it?
Very careful.
Yeah, if it's a guy talking to a woman about how much he loves and adores her, wants to marry her, it's probably different than how you feel about Bill.
Well, how do you
hopefully,
tell?
Depending on what city
you live in. How do you tell someone that you love them in a godly way?
Hey, Bill,
say, God, I love.
If I say I love you, how do you take it?
For between you and me, it would be agape love.
So in context,
okay.
Yeah.
So that's context.
So the other person had to kind of interpret what you
exactly.
were saying.
Yeah, that's what he's saying. There's multiple meanings. In other words, I say I love you. You could take that any number of different ways. Brotherly love, mm-hmm. sexual love, you know.
But I
would
assume
you
mean brotherly love.
But you understand, because it's me, it doesn't mean sexual. So you that's in context. That's how Aramaic works. In other words, I'm talking to you. You understand by what I've said before, what I've said after, and our relationship. You have an understanding of what I mean with that word.
So you would think that if the Bible is... Sorry, I'm taking time up here, but I can't wrap my head around this. You would think if the Bible was written in English, it would be more exact than if it was written in Aramaic. Because we've got different words.
It is more exact.
Then why are you taking us back to the Aramaic?
Because... Okay. Just like Sunday, we were looking at the first line of the Lord's Prayer. You could translate that literally about two dozen different ways and be dead on in terms of what those words mean. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be thy name. It could be translated dozens of literally different ways based on all the meanings that exist simultaneously in those words. So here's the problem. You know, in English, we have to choose one. Just one of all those dozens of possible meanings. How do we know we chose the right one? How do we know we chose the one that was most important to the speaker, to the writer? See, if all those meanings exist simultaneously, in the Aramaic mind, they all coexist together. They're aware of the possible meanings. They bring them into the fold of possible meaning. When we translate into a language like Greek or English, we've got to choose one, or we've got to start adding a bunch of words, you know, like the Amplified Bible does, to try to bring in the sense of the other meanings that are possible. You notice the paraphrase that I wrote of that one simple line, you know, just three or four words in Aramaic, had to be this long to try to capture the essence of what's possible and what I think is and what other scholars think is the most natural and most pertinent passage.
I want to go offline with you on this, but I would like to submit this, and perhaps this will be beneficial. It seems to me that the context of what was happening when the words were being said is more important.
The context of what?
Exactly what was happening when Jesus said the words. For instance,
yeah.
You talk a lot about the picture of the virgins and the lamps and the guy coming to get the bride. And that is what was happening in that time, which is assisting us in understanding a limited language. That's how my brain is seeing it. The language is limited, so we need a word picture. The word picture is the guy coming to get his bride. In English, we can say 50 words, so we don't need the picture of the guy coming to get the bride.
Well, to say that Aramaic is limited, I think, is a bias. It's not limited. It was, if anything, it was richer than our language. But you have to approach it in a different way. Mm-hmm. See, if we approach it linearly, if we approach it with our mindset, we're only going to shave off the top level layer of meaning, and we're going to miss everything. And as you say, if we don't bring it back into the context, then we're going to miss the meaning altogether.
But Dave, what you're doing is deeper than a lot of the stuff that we hear on the radio and on TV. Because what they do is they say, oh, that's the Greek word, and that Greek word means blah, blah, blah. You're going one level deeper.
Well, many levels.
Oh, going a lot more than just one level deeper.
Okay, well,
yeah. But so yeah, you're absolutely right that we are going deeper. But that's the whole point of this, is that we don't understand. I try to tell people all the time is that the words that we have transmitted to us of Scripture are very good. You know, it's not that we have the wrong words. It's not that the text has really been corrupted in any way that we can see. That really destroys the meaning of the text. It's amazing how good for 2,000 years the Bible has been transmitted. The problem is, we don't understand what the words mean anymore.
Yeah.
We've got the right words, but we don't understand them. And the biggest damage is because now it's in English, we think we do. We think we do understand, but we don't because we haven't put it back into that context. Let me give you a perfect example. Sandy and I were talking, you know, before we started, and she was asking me questions about divorce and remarriage. And that famous section in Matthew 5, Matthew 19, and Luke, what did you say, was 14? 16? Okay, that deal with divorce and remarriage are a perfect example of how context changes everything. From that, we have gleaned from the simple English that there is only one reason that you can be divorced legitimately, and that's if your spouse has committed adultery. That's the only reason for a divorce. And if you do divorce for any other reason, if you remarry, you are committing adultery. That's the plain reading. That's what the church has been bludgeoning divorcees with for 2,000 years. All right?
Unless you're Catholic, and then you buy an annulment.
Exactly. All right. What we don't understand, and what we've only started to understand recently, as enough archaeological evidence has been unearthed, as scholars have read a lot more of the contemporary rabbinical text, is to find out the context of what was going on at the time. And what was happening was a generational debate about the nature of divorce and remarriage within Judaism. In the first century BC, two Pharisaical schools developed, one headed by Hillel, one headed by Shammai. Hillel and his school took the first reference from Deuteronomy and put the two together, so that basically what they said was that you could divorce for any matter, was the way that they formulated it. And I can't remember the actual text from Deuteronomy, but they took two things, and, well, they took one thing and they split it. So it was kind of like the text said, for a matter of indecency, I think was the way it was in the original text. And what they said was, it was for any matter and indecency, so they split the two things apart. So basically, you could divorce your spouse, your wife generally, for any matter, and the shorthand was, if you spoiled your dinner, you could divorce her. So basically what you had was a no-fault divorce. So by the first century CE, when Jesus is on the scene, basically anybody who wanted a divorce could go to a Hillelite judge, all right, just needing to go to the right judge, and you could get a divorce for any matter. Now the Shammites were holding back to the original idea, and they said it was for a matter of indecency. In other words, they took the two pieces that the Hillels had split apart and put back together again. And that was their shorthand for saying, no, we stand by the old tradition. But the old tradition allowed five reasons for divorce, not just one. And so adultery was one of them, but was so was neglect of food and love and clothing. And so was infertility. And all, those were all reasons for divorce within the system. The Shammites recognized all five. They coded it by saying a matter of indecency, because that was their way of fighting the way that the Hillelites had split it apart. When the Pharisees come to Jesus and say, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any matter, that you're using the exact formulation of the Hillelites. What they're asking him is to choose between the two schools of thought.
Is that interesting?
And so when he responds, first, what does he do?
In
perfect Jesus style, he doesn't answer the question.
Exactly.
What does he do? He goes back and says, in the beginning, this was what marriage was supposed to be. He tries to go back to the intent of the heart. And he's trying to teach them, man was supposed to be joined to woman in this beautiful, mystical union, and nothing was supposed to take it apart. But because of your hardened hearts, Moses gave you a decree of divorce, because you couldn't handle it the way it was supposed to be handled. But they press him for an answer, and finally he says, okay, then it's for a matter of indecency. In other words, what is he saying? I'm siding with the Shammites and not the Hillelites. It can't be for any reason. But he's still recognizing the five reasons for divorce. We're not supposed to live with an abusive partner. We were never supposed to do that. And then he goes on in Luke 14 and says, if you divorce and marry another, it's the same as adultery. But the sense of the Aramaic and the Greek there is, if you divorce in order to marry another, it's as if it's the same as adultery. And of course we see that. It goes back to the intent. Because what was happening at the time? Older men were divorcing their older wives because they fancied...
You mean it happened
faith.
Back then? I thought it was just Western.
So they had their wife at any time they wanted to go for the next young thing.
Unbelievable.
It's the same as adultery. See, you need the context.
Why don't they teach that, like you?
Because
why?
Didn't know the context. The church didn't know. All they had was this little text, and they were reading it through the lens of the Greek and eventually the local language, you know, whatever the vernacular happened to be, and they didn't know the context. It seems to say, the simple meaning, the plain meaning, seems to say exactly what the church has been abusing people
yes.
for centuries. But it doesn't
still is.
They still are, of course. Yeah. They are. But that's not the intent.
So was it the words, it was the concept.
You needed to know the specified jargon that was being used.
Yes.
Once you know that they asked him with a specific legal jargon that the Hillelites were using, and that he answered in the specific jargon that the Shammites used, now you know what he was doing. He was siding with one school over another. Mm-hmm. But see, this is why it's so important. As you say, context is everything. We need to know the context as well as we can. That's why these scholars who pore over, you know, all these piles of ancient manuscripts in order to recreate as best they can the context of the times and are willing to go through all that detail, they're doing such a great service to us. That's why the Dead Sea Scrolls were such an incredible find, because even though they didn't contain any New Testament books at all, they gave us this wealth of information that illuminated the context of first century Palestine, first century Judea, so that we could understand more in context what's going on in these New Testament books. So does that help?
Yes.
Okay. You know, and my point that I'm trying to make right now is, even though I tend to side with the Greek primacy, in other words, that the books of the New Testament were written in Greek first, I still think that the Aramaic text, even though it appears to be a translation from the Greek, is still giving us a better window into the original intent of Jesus' words. Because especially written by native speakers only a couple hundred years, maybe even contemporaneously or shortly after the original Greek was written, they're going to know what words were being used at that time and how to translate those much better than we would today. And so the chances that they got it right are very, very good. And when you actually start to go through some of these things, it gets even better. Now, you guys want to spend a little bit more time past 9 o'clock and get into this, or you want to save it for next week? Where are y'all at?
If it's got to be shortened.
What's that?
If it's got to be shortened, then let's not get into it. But if we're going to go long enough to really get the full stuff.
Let's dive into some of it, because we've led up to it so beautifully. It would be hard to break it off now and start again. If you turn the page, what I've just given you is a sheet that doesn't need a whole lot of comment, but I just wanted you to see the Lord's Prayer, first in the English translation, in the actual Estrangula script of the Aramaic, and then a pronunciation guide, a transliteration.
Can you?
Which
one do you want us to read?
You can read any one. Read the middle column.
Yeah, middle one. Start
the middle one.
You go, Catherine.
Show us how it's done.
Even try reading it from the third column.
That's even difficult. That's good, though, buddy. All right. Let's turn the page again.
Can you just quickly go say it, your pronunciation? Can you say the Lord's Prayer?
The first few lines would be Arun Devashmaya, Nitkarashama, Taitai Malkuta, Neve Sevyana, Aichana Devashmaya, Uvvera Haflam. Something like that.
It's beautiful.
Yeah. I'm pronouncing it poorly, of course.
It doesn't sound like
I tried to find a really good native speaker, and it was all sort of a Goldilocks thing. One was like really clipped and short and without much passion or meaning to it. The other one was like a wound of us.
That was beautifully read, though.
And so I haven't been able to find one, but just from my poor reading, and I was stressing this on Sunday too, it's just an absolutely gorgeous
language.
There's a resonance to it and a roundness to it and a beauty. As much as it's difficult to watch the Passion of the Christ, it's maybe just turn off the visual and just listen to the language. Because they did a pretty good job. I mean, yeah, the purists were all over it saying, oh, they used the wrong dialect, they used the wrong dialect. Mm-hmm. But it gives you a sense of what the language would have sounded like conversationally.
And that's Aramaic.
It's just gorgeous. Yeah, Aramaic, when Jesus is speaking and his friends are speaking, and of course when Pilate's speaking, he's speaking Latin. And so there's the different ancient languages being used as they would have been. But to hear the spoken language, it's beautiful. And you're right, it's got this rhythm and a sense to it. And one of the things that we miss so much is there are so many plays on words. The use of assonance, similar sounds within the words as a poetic device, is used throughout. And one of the ways that some of these scholars are recreating what the Galilean dialect, the Jewish dialect of Aramaic, would have sounded like, are by using these plays on words and realizing that Jesus would have done that. Mm-hmm. Because that's what you did for mnemonic devices, ways to remember scripts, and to make it just that much more poetic. Jewish poetry doesn't use necessarily sounds and rhyme the way we do. It uses repeating concepts the way we would use rhyme. But it still uses those devices, in just making the language beautiful. But it's an absolutely gorgeous language. It's just got that sound to it. And maybe because it was closer to the beginning of things, it came out of that deep place of the people's being. I don't know, but it's just it's a gorgeous sounding language.
It is beautiful.
Yeah.
So
why
does this have one language?
It depends on who you're talking to, which one of those that they think it was. You know, the Hindus think it was Sanskrit. That was the divine language. And the Jews obviously think that Hebrew was the divine language. But it seems clear that Hebrew evolved from a previous language. So, what was that one language? I don't know.
Hebrew evolved from another language?
There's so many beautiful languages that, when we started babbling, it came out so beautifully. Like you said, just your appreciation of this language is just absolutely wonderful. I guess, again, it doesn't matter which came first.
Catherine, we were talking about Hebrew either could have evolved out of Aramaic, or Hebrew and Aramaic could have evolved out of a previous mother tongue. But all these Semitic languages are really close. And so what was spoken by the Chaldeans, what was spoken by the Akkadians, what was spoken by some of these other early Sumerians, Mesopotamian Semitic cultures from which all of these languages derived, we don't know. But they do.
What did Adam and Eve talk to God?
Who knows? Nobody knows.
Phonetics.
But the third language that is closely related to Hebrew and Aramaic is Arabic.
Yeah.
And Arabic, it follows along. In fact, most of the words are very similar and share the same roots. So, yeah. I mean, the easy one is peace, shalom, mm-hmm. in Hebrew, shlama or salama in Aramaic, right. And salam in Arabic. They all share the same roots. The shin, the lamed, and the mem, or S-L-M, are there in each one. The only thing that changes are the vowels. You see, but the consonants are the same in all three languages. Mm-hmm. The word for God, El Eloah in Hebrew, Alaha in Aramaic, Allah. And so you see again the Aleph and the Lamed both being the roots of that word. And so in those languages there are these close similarities, and then of course they split off as well. But they're very closely related. Peter?
Yeah, David. The languages that came before Hebrew, were they a vowel-based, consonant-based languages? Do you know?
Of the ones that we know, most of them are, yes. But
most of them are. So then, when Bill was asking his question, you made a comment about the Amplified Bible, which is a good way of looking at it. But I don't know how to phrase this. In ancient Hebrew, we have like three vowels and whatever, and when we don't know the vowels and we don't have the signs, then we can attribute various meanings to that word. Like, for example, the word Adam has, I believe, eight possible meanings, depending on where you put the vowels, right? However, these meanings are related in a symbolic way. I mean, you could take all these meanings, like red dust and duh, and put them together and say, okay, these three letters are a symbol for all these concepts, and these concepts are affiliated with one another. And that's an interesting thing, considering that the ancients worked with symbols and shortcuts, and okay, this stands for all that sort of stuff, and this stands for all that related sort of stuff. That's so interesting. I wonder whether we lose that. In other words, when we have a brief language limited amounts of words, but those words are symbolic in a way for a number of different concepts which have a relationship. It seems necessary to focus in and to focus out to get the full gist of what has been said. You see it anyway?
No, I absolutely agree. Yeah. And you're right, because we talked about this in this language, this what's called the root and pattern system. We talked about this as well. Each letter has a meaning, and as you start to put two letters together, you get what's called a parent root. And so L would be a parent root. The parent roots are the oldest. It's almost like again going back in time. The older, more primitive roots are the shorter ones. You know, when they just took two letters together, the Aleph and the Bet. So the ox, the symbol of strength, and the Bet, the symbol of the house. So strong house. So father was one who brings strength to the house. And so those parent roots, anything that has av in it, the A and the B, the aleph and the bet, is going to be related to that. As you start stringing more and more letters together, and you put the third letter on, you got the child root, you put the fourth letter on, you have words. All of those are going to be from that same family, and they're all going to have that same root meaning to them. So even if you've got a word now that's related to it, and I can bring you some diagrams of some of these, because it's really interesting if you guys are interested. But it's all going to have a meaning that's related to the first root that they come from. And so the same thing with Adam, he uses as an example.
And it's interesting that I think nouns, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think nouns have this, this sure. symbolic head of a family of affinities. And verb seems to be the opposite. Like, if I'm not mistaken, the word for love in Hebrew has six possible meanings. And yet those are not affiliated. Those are separate. The love of a baby in the womb and, these different things. So, jumping from English to Greek to Hebrew, there are a lot of possibilities. We have a lot of words, but we don't have a symbol that stands for them. So we can say, I love my dog, I love the Red Sox, I love, and we don't exactly, we have to sort of guess at it from context, but, going in and out, just like the Amplified Bible, just throwing in every possible meaning gives you insight, and then condensing it into a symbol also gives you meaning.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing is that all those meanings are present, and is a possible translation. Because there is so much richness there. The other interesting thing about Hebrew is it's based on the verbs and not on the nouns. The nouns come from the verbs. And so, father is understood as the one who brings strength to the house. So even as a noun, it implies action. Mm-hmm. Berek, a blessing, is what is given on bended knee. And so Berek also means knee. So knee and blessing are connected in the Hebrew mind. So sometimes the connections, and we went through some of these before, the connections are not obvious to us. Why would knee and a blessing come from the same root? Because the blessing is what is received or given on bended knee. And so, but it's all based on action. The Hebrew language, Aramaic language, is based on action, where our language is based more on a kind of abstract intellectual we concern ourselves more with nouns and adjectives, right? Because we're focused on what we see and how we describe what we see. Hebrew is based on verbs and adverbs. What is the action? How is it taking place? And the actor is seen as one who is performing the action rather than as a separate entity, from the verb of the action. So it's a whole different mindset. And moving into that mindset helps to understand. And it helps us understand something about the nature of our faith. When we look at a word like faith and belief, and we understand it as an abstract, intellectual, mental assent, mental agreement to agree to believe something. And then you realize that in Hebrew Aramaic, it's the action that comes from a consistent action, an action that will be continued no matter what happens. That's really what faith is. So faith isn't what we think or what we believe. Faith is what we do. And so when we start to understand the nature of Hebrew and Aramaic and how it's constructed, then we start to look for that. So whenever you see the word belief or faith in the Bible, and we think we have to think something, realize that to the Hebrew reader, to the Hebrew listener, that's going to be something that you do. That's why someone like James, another very Hebrew book in the Bible, says that faith without works is dead. Well, Martin Luther, 15th century European, is going to go ballistic. And he did. He thought the book of James should have been thrown out of the Bible. Why? Because it violated the idea of sola fides, or faith alone saves. Because here's this guy saying without the works, it's dead. Well, the works were what he was trying to get away from the Roman church, which had all these obligations and things that you had to do. And he's saying, now here's this book saying this. But he misunderstood that to the Jew, faith and works were the same thing. It's two sides of the same thing. Aramaic and Hebrew don't distinguish between what's happening interiorly and what's happening exteriorly. So as you think, so as you do. What you believe is what happens. And so the individual and the community were one thing. The interior person and the exterior person were one thing. To the Jew, everything was one thing, you know, in God. And God's name, Aloha, Aloha, means unity itself. And so, very different mindset. And that's why, again, the context is so important for us to understand. You know, if you don't believe, then you have no part of me. So we think, okay, there's a creed, I got to sign off on all that. No, if you don't live as I lived, then you have no part of me. That's what he's trying to get across. Changes everything. And so, trying to get back into this language and understand it from that point of view has everything to do with how we're going to live out our faith lives. So that's why a study like this is so important from my point of view. Is if we can get back into that mindset, now we can start living our lives. We don't have to live under the burden of a church that says if you get divorced because your husband was beating you, you can never get married again. Well, good grief, we can toss that out the window. And then for those who say that you've got to sign off on this creed or you're going to hell, well, we can toss that one out the window. And we can realize, you know what? Jesus and God actually have a little bit of common sense. Not both of them. You know? They don't violate the common sense. If you're reading something in Scripture and it makes no common sense, you know, you can pretty much bet that there's been a misinterpretation, a left turn at Albuquerque someplace, and we've got to go back to the source and find out where we made the wrong turn. Go back. Because God is a God of common sense. It makes perfect sense. You know, it's fair, it's loving, it's all of those things. And when we get out there someplace where we got to just say, you know, that's just the way it is, you know, it doesn't make any sense, violates everything that you think you know, even though, you know, non-believers are actually acting better than the believers now, you know, it's like, okay, figure it out, we got to go back. And that's what this allows us to do. And I skipped over a bunch of people with hands up. Oh, Bill.
Yeah, actually, I was really appreciating Bill's question.
Peter?
Huh? Bill.
Bill, okay, yeah.
William, excuse me.
William.
And because, let's say that I have a concept in mind, and I translate it in Greek, and I translate it in Aramaic. Well, maybe the Aramaic, because of its richness, carries the fuller meaning of my concept, or maybe because of the non-specificity of the language, the Greek would more properly carry my meaning. How do you tell? Yeah, how do you tell when, if one's reading Aramaic, if the author is trying to say something specific, or if they're trying to talk about a broad concept of things? Because as we were saying before, that they're probably people just speaking. They weren't dictating scripture at the time, so they're just talking.
Let me put it
and
to you this way:
we're not there watching them go like that. You know?
Languages don't come out of nowhere.
Yeah,
they come out of the culture from which they were born.
Right.
And so each language has a purpose and is suited to that purpose because it came out of that people. So Greek suits its people very well. Mm-hmm. English suits us very well. Mm-hmm. We're linear. We're intellectual. We're abstract. We're interested in the mechanization of things, breaking it down to its constituent parts, and then reprogramming it and making it work for us. The Greeks were involved in philosophy and trying to parse, you know, bits and pieces of the universe and understand it, breaking it down into its smallest parts. And Hebrew and Aramaic comes from a nomadic, either pastoral people who raised livestock, or agrarians, people who grew. They were involved in harmonizing themselves with all of the seasons of the year, moving and becoming part of the landscape in order for them to survive. Whether they were following their herds or whether they were following their crops and the seasons and the plantings and the harvest and all of that, their language is suited for that. Their spirituality comes out of their rootedness in their world and in nature and in the turning of the planet. And so their language expresses all of that very well. It's not very good at expressing the mechanistic modern. You couldn't use Aramaic very well to express what we need to express in our culture today. They'd have to add you know, hundreds and thousands of words to be able to express that. It's not good at that. But if you think about the nature of spirituality, it's much more like that agrarian pastoral existence than it is like our mechanized industrial existence. We have come so far and removed ourselves so far from what it means to be part of the earth and part of nature that it's almost unrecognizable. So if we want to get back to what those people experience and how they experience their God, the best way is to try to move into their mindset and use their language as kind of a springboard to be able to do that. And if for no other reason, it's the language Jesus expressed himself in, and it was perfectly up to the task of doing so. So there's going to be no loss. It's not going to be limited to understand Jesus in his own words. Are you going someplace, buddy?
I was just in line with what you were talking when you were describing this, and I think you've spoke on this tribe before, where their language was so limited, they don't have a word for goodbye. They don't have a word for death. They have no time. There is not 2 o'clock, mm-hmm. But they share the love of their children, that the sun mm-hmm. rises, you know, that all these things. But it's so hard for us to get our arms around that they communicate well with each other, but we're like, how can you not say goodbye when you're leaving? There's just no word for it. So it struck me while you were speaking. I remember you saying, and I've seen that show.
He's talking about the Moken, yeah. The sea gypsies of the Andaman Sea that really came into national attention after the tsunami about 5 years ago, mm-hmm. because they were the only ones that survived without a single loss because they were able to read the sea so well. But they're one of these indigenous peoples that have been so isolated from the modern world that they've kept their own lifestyle to a huge degree. And they don't have a concept of time, of linear time. So they don't have words for hello and goodbye. They don't know how old they are. They don't mark any of those things. Either someone's present or they're not. But there's no sadness at goodbye. There's no celebration when the person returns. They're either present or they're not, and that's just fine with them. You know, there's no word for thank you. There's no concept of ownership, personal ownership. It's like all of the people are one organism with many moving parts. And so, of course, what's mine is yours and yours is mine. There's no sense of personal ownership. So they don't need a word for it, you know? Eskimos have, 20 different words for snow? But they don't have a word for, I don't know, mention something at the equator. Right. They don't need that word. And so it's like that. The languages come out of the needs of the people and who they are and how they understand life and their part in it and their God.
I don't want to drive this on, but what about Babel? When God just made everybody speak different languages. That didn't come out of a society. That came out of a command.
Okay, well, it depends on how you want to look at those.
I guess I don't know that. Oh, okay. Yeah. No, no, I need to be educated by you, so I forget
that. Well, no, that's fine. That's fine. We can talk about it here.
You know, a stupid question.
If we look at that literally,
I understand.
Then God confused the languages because the people had grown so arrogant
yeah.
that they were working against their own purposes. Mm-hmm. You know, another way of looking at it is a people trying to explain why there are so many languages as they look around. Because they know we all came from one source. There had to be one language at one point. And now there are all these languages. Why are they?
Well, it doesn't say
did the story
that
literally
languages.
Happen? Was it an attempt to try to explain? You know, there's going to be Christians that are going to come on all sides.
What is your thoughts? What do you lean to? Do you think it's...
I tend to lean to a more figurative interpretation of certain books. Not all books. When you get into a book like Kings and Chronicles, that's good history. And we're finding out more and more with each archaeological dig how good the history is. But when you get into books like At the Beginning and the End, Genesis and Revelation, they were used very figuratively. The story in Eden was meant to describe deep truths, but not necessarily to be good science. You know, that's what I believe anyway.
No, that makes
I get tar and feathered for that, but I'll
throw
it out.
You know,
I believe that it was trying to get across truths, deep truths, about the nature of our beginnings and our relationship with God, but it wasn't trying to be accurate. You know, Revelation as an apocalyptic book is trying to do specific things using figurative language. And I think stories like Babel are also part of that genre. But I'm prepared to be wrong on
that.
You know, it doesn't really matter to me so much.
I'll give you a little perspective about that story, because one thing that it says in there, God looked down and said, look at the people, they're all of one language. Nothing will be impossible for them. So you look at that. So there's a context there that he's saying nothing will be impossible for them. And the common sense thing is you look at the world today and how the internet has brought people almost to one language and what's developing out of that, the technologies and all that. But you can almost say, because of the internet, nothing will be impossible. Mm-hmm. So that's the context of that, where the common sense thing is, well, if you broke up all the languages, now the engineers can't talk to each other, mm-hmm. nobody can communicate, you just stopped all the progress. Just like if the internet went down, what would happen?
Mm-hmm. It doesn't say he gave them new languages, it says he confused the language. Well, there's a big difference.
No.
But it has that common sense element to it we were talking about.
It doesn't say
why
that
would he do
sad.
That?
And those people started talking Chinese.
True.
It just says he confused the language.
Right.
I mean, what does that mean? Right.
Which stopped all progress.
Yeah.
So they couldn't communicate amongst themselves. So therefore, obviously, one was speaking something different than the other.
But it went on to say that they moved to their different groups of languages, so they could communicate.
Right. They did.
Well, I went to Texas, and I couldn't understand anything.
Yeah, but the food's good. Yeah. I think what you're
we
saying...
Sent you back.
You had that one coming.
The Aramaic, Hebrew, those that were in the agricultural or whatever, they all spoke with such passion. I mean, like, that's why I think that movie was called The Passion of Christ. Because that's what I got out of that movie. I mean, other than it's fabulous, it's the passion of the people.
Absolutely.
And we don't have that.
That's a really interesting, Catherine.
That we don't have that physical action. You get around a good Jewish family, they are just like, or a Greek family, are they just amazing? They're just kind of over the top.
They're very burlish.
But they're very...
They're feeling Italian, too.
It's kind of energizing to be around someone, and you know what they're thinking, and, they don't hold back anything. And they don't even have to say everything. And we're very verbose, and we have to be so accurate, and that's probably why our Bill of Rights has grown to this, monstrosity it has, because we have to have all these little things. It's actually quite... the more words we have, I think, the less freedom we have.
That's true.
Oh, absolutely.
Because we have, what do you mean by that? Right. You know what I mean? Yeah. Well, I just said this, but what that mean?
But that's the same thing that happened with the Jews, too. Okay. The Pharisees, they added more and more and more and more. Exactly. That's just human nature. Once you're on that legal train, then nothing's going to stop you.
And the other thing I was thinking of, too, as you were talking about, getting back to the basics, I was thinking of how funny that is in today's society. I remember always having... when I was a little girl, having cakes, my mother would make cakes from scratch, right? Mm-hmm. And now we just buy it in the box. Mm-hmm. It's still a cake, right?
Says who?
Me, it's still good. But I'm just saying that, you're going back into the actual building of the Bible. To me, it's like building a cake out of scratch. Versus just getting the box
in hand.
I like that analogy.
That is a great one.
They both are cakes.
You're very good, Catherine.
That one is much more in depth.
The scratch one does taste better.
Now, let me just emphasize that.
You enjoy it more.
Once again, context is everything. Mm-hmm. I believe that when you look at the context and the intent of a book like Genesis or Revelation, it at least the beginning, the first few chapters of Genesis, force you into a more figurative understanding. Others vehemently disagree, of course, and young Earth creationists will fight tooth and nail that every point is exactly according to the laws of physics, and they'll go to great lengths to prove it. I don't really have a dog in that race. I don't really care, because to me, as long as God created, the mechanics behind it are fine with me. It doesn't really matter. It seems to me that the context is moving us in a figurative understanding, but that's one thing that I really want to lay down as any prerequisite. It's just not. You can understand this the way that the Spirit is leading you to understand it. As long as you're not violating common sense, and as long as you're not just simply sweeping facts under the rug, that's what we're trying to do here, to bring all this stuff to bear so that your faith is something that you can really stand on. It's something that you can communicate, and it's something that leads you in the direction of direct experience with God that is going to create in you the connection, the unity, and the oneness that allow you to stand against the difficulties that are going to come up in your life. I mean, we're looking at a very scary world here. Mm-hmm. It's turning sideways and up and down, and you can feel the amount of tension and anxiety that's coming out in people. And it's starting to really tear at the fabric of our country. And as we go forward, you know, it's going to get worse before it gets any better. Obviously, where's your faith then? You know, where's your faith that the stock market really crashes, or you lose your job, or God forbid that the fabric of our society starts to unravel, as it has in every other civilization that's ever graced the face of the planet? Is it not going to happen to us? Well, of course it is. You know, what do we do then? You know, if we haven't gotten to the place where we really know that God exists and we have this relationship with Him, we won't stand that type of test. That's what we're trying to get to here. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's what all of this is about. Yeah, Scotty.
It's interesting, as I continue to come to this, we're now 17 sessions in, and I shared with you when we first started this, it was a little scary. It's like you're disassembling everything that I've based 18 years of feeling comfortable about what I think I know about God to mean. But I had this natural sense of knowing, stick it out, there's a greater gift waiting from my understanding at the end of this journey. What it's really causing me to do, as we continue to do more disassembly of everything I believed I thought I knew, is really a question: if I can't depend upon any of that book, because you may think one thing, Bill may think another thing, this Bill may think that, Kathleen thinks this, Dave thinks that, I mean, it just goes on and on and on. What am I left with? What could, if I still want to believe there even is a God, what is it? What happens to me at that point? To everything I leaned on, to everything that, every strength that I drew upon to get through some really ugly stuff in life, where would I be? And for me personally, it's causing me to find a new relationship with God that I just didn't even thought I got.
Yeah.
And now I'm finding out I really do got.
That's that passion, right?
For me, it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
some
that's
people
very good. It's an
see something different. But
what's that line when you have finally eliminated all of the impossible? Whatever is left, no matter how implausible, must be the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, something like that. I may have paraphrased it badly. But what Ingrid had said in here a couple of months ago, she said she felt like everything was falling away, and I said, great,
good.
Because at the point that everything you think you know that's familiar falls away, what's left is the truth, is the core of things. You know, I'm not trying to strip anybody of anything here. I'm hoping we're adding to it. But there will be a winnowing process as you go through this, and that's okay. But if you really start to feel like you're losing it, let's talk, because that's not the goal here. The goal here is to just add all this stuff on and see if we can hear God's voice. You know, I love that image of the RCA dog. His name is Nipper. You know, the one looking. It's like his master's voice. He knew his master's voice, even from an unfamiliar context. He still knew it was his master's voice. Can we do that? Can we learn our master's voice so well that even if it's coming from an unfamiliar context, we still know it, the sound of it, and we're prepared to follow it? And that's what pursuit does.
That's the Holy Spirit.
Well, the other thing too I've heard over and over is that a lot of Christians tend to take the Bible and they worship it. And we're not supposed to worship the Bible. We're supposed to worship God.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, to take it so literally and to fight over it, mm-hmm. to fight over every word, that's not what God meant that to be. It's a book that, you know, is different for every person. You know, you open up scripture and what it says to you, it'll say something different to me, because the words are living and active and they're meant for us individually. But we don't worship that. We just ask God to speak to us.
I like what you said, Dave. If it doesn't have common sense, then it's, you better read it again.
And what Mary is saying is true, that our intellectual understanding can change. However, our actions should be the same. If our actions don't look like Jesus, if it doesn't look like love as Jesus proclaimed it, then we can definitely say we've got a wrong thought in our head. But if our actions look the same and our thoughts are just different than somebody else, well then, I, as far as I'm concerned, it's not broke. Don't fix it. You know?
Very
don't.
Interesting.
Yeah. I personally agree with what we're doing and all this. But every now and then I run up against people that say, you know, they do
Bible slinging, and it's like, lean not upon your own understanding, rely upon the Holy Spirit to tell you what to do, and all this stuff you're doing is really not the right thing. I don't agree with that, but what's a decent answer to those guys?
First of all, it's contradictory on its face.
Yes.
I mean, if you say lean not on your understanding, but lean on the Holy Spirit, and yet you're leaning on the understanding of the people that have come to you from generations before.
Yes.
I mean, whose understanding comprises the teachings of any given church? It's a family. It's a generational transmission of interpretation. If we're really focusing on the Spirit, that's going to give us the most diversity,
right,
not the least.
Right.
But what it's not going to do is give us a diversity in action. See, remember, the language is based on action. The whole understanding is based on action. Our actions will be unified. That's where we become one, in living and loving and relating to each other the way that Jesus related to his friends and the way the Father related to him. That's where our unity comes in. You want unity of the church, that's where you'll find it. Not in the thought processes that got us here. And if we are really following the Spirit, there's going to be lots of diversity. Nothing wrong with that, as long as we come and stand shoulder to shoulder in the field. That's all I can tell you.
I 100% agree with that. I don't think I could pull that off in about 4 or 5 words.
But it's almost like the burning of the bosom. Saying if you have the burning of the bosom, that you know, I mean, that's just kind of foolish.
Well, one good way to teach somebody else that would be against what Dave's teaching would be to do what he did. Explain how you learned how that statement about divorce makes common sense instead of taking it just as that one rule. I mean, when you did that and laid it out, it's like, how could you think any other way? Because that's the common sense way.
Of course, the shortest answer is that
okay.
And you're not going to be able to convince anybody who doesn't want to be convinced.
True.
Yeah,
you know, they've already drawn their lines in the sand. All they're going to do is fight with you.
But that showed a good story, you know, how you would
really
take
is.
It. And then you showed the full story.
So.
And in doing so, you really showed who. Because when you think about that, that causes more people that are Christians, that are going through divorce or contemplating divorce, stopping and not going to church anymore and not fellowshipping and not being accepted and all those things.
And look how many people will be set free by
hearing
that.
I know, it's so true.
And how much a better family unity in a Christian church. And plus, it's just so like Jesus. He didn't want me to be married to someone that was verbally rude, mean, physically mean, or any of those things. I mean,
Paul even says God has called us to peace. And so what peace is there in an abusive relationship? Are we supposed to just endure that?
Well, I was told my first husband and I divorced, and he was an alcoholic, and he was emotionally abusive when he drank.
Mm-hmm.
Nicest guy in the world when he was sober, but when he drank, he was just mean.
Mm-hmm.
And we divorced, and afterward, a pastor told me that I needed to go back to him.
Mm-hmm.
And that he had seen miracles happen, and that, you know, if I just prayed hard enough, you know, God would fix that, and otherwise I would be coming back.
That's terrible.
Is that to your prayer life?
Yes. So that, you know, that could have caused him to be.
Well, your prayer really transformed Dave.
So, can we come up with a different? This isn't disassembly of the Bible that we're doing.
No.
Because
no.
I don't want to walk out of here feeling like we're a group disassembling and reassembling. It's an understanding.
Right. Yeah.
You know what?
It's an enrichment.
Yeah. You know what I tell people
because
is.
Because I don't want to feel like.
No. What I tell people is because they see me as going so far afield from the literal understanding of the Bible, I tell people I want to be the most literal guy in the room. But I want to be literal to the point of the first hearer of Jesus' words. What would that understanding and not the understanding that we have so far removed in space and time and worldview?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I want to be. If Matthew was sitting right there, I'd be at his feet. What exactly did you mean? Where did that come from?
Mm-hmm.
That's the understanding I want to have, not the understanding passed down from generation to generation. We had lunch with Chuck Smith Jr. just last week, and he said, I can't believe the things you're getting away with teaching in that class. And so it's a real commendation
with
to all
you.
Of you
yeah.
that you're willing to sit here and go through this re-understanding, if you want to put it that way.
Yeah, it's interesting. as Pastor Darrell just said, the disassembly project, I wondered, to be honest with you, I wondered if something I had said had prompted that feeling. Because I talked about how, as all this was stripped away, if I, in that process of sharing my thoughts, left anybody feeling the same way, he didn't want to feel that way, for me, maybe what I neglected to say, I thought, I assumed, one of my major faux pas in life, that somebody would have gotten this out of my content, is as we stripped away the traditional Western teachings that I received for 20 or more years of my life, actually way more years than that, what I'm coming to understand is a Bible that is so rich, so deep, so meaningful, so passionate, so living and active, beyond what I ever even imagined or thought based on my previous understandings. So for me personally, I'm just talking about a personal experience here, to me it makes me, I can't wait to get to these classes. I want to take what you, like I said, for the very first time, the whole teaching on where writing and how it was developed, everything we, last week, I had an occasion to share with a guy who considered himself fairly well schooled in the Bible. And when I showed him what you taught us and what how long it's about, it's like, this just changes everything. So yeah, it does. It's what I'm learning.
So if there's any deconstruction going on, maybe that's a better word than disassembly, it's to our own thought process and worldview and not the text of the Bible itself.
Absolutely.
What we're trying to do is uncover what the text really says.
Absolutely.
Rather than deconstruct it or disassemble it. But in the process of doing that, we have to deconstruct what we think about the text in order to get there. Otherwise, we'll never get there. We'll always have a barrier. We won't go beyond what we think we know. If we're willing to sacrifice what we think we know, then we can get to what Jesus is trying to do.
This class is so fabulous. It's like going into finding an old room with cobwebs and then looking up on a shelf and taking this book off and blowing it and then opening up the first page and it just comes to life. That's the teacher.
It is. That's an incredible journey.
And you know, for me, it's very freeing.
Yes.
I think that if we get to that point, and I know I have always been, we read this when I first started learning the Bible, and we just, you know, people can just get so hard, be so hard on themselves. And or even maybe how you're raised, being raised Catholic, thinking I'll never measure up. Mm-hmm. But really getting to the context, like you're saying, of what it really means, it is more freeing and more loving, even. You know that.
Every time that I have gone from a Greek understanding, Western understanding, to the Aramaic, what has struck me is that the love of God, or God as unconditional lover, is absolutely reaffirmed. Mm-hmm. In any other understanding where that seemed to be contradicted or chipped away from, when I went back to the Aramaic, it was absolutely put back together again. I never expected to go the other way, because what I'm realizing now is that the separation that we sometimes see or understand in the text is the misunderstanding. Mm-hmm. The true understanding is always unity and unconditional love. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're going with. And it just affirms it every single time. So, obviously, we're not going to get where I was going to go tonight. But what we're going to do, starting right off next week, is I want to tell you the story of the Assyrian church, because it's the greatest secret story never told. How did the Peshitta survive? The Peshitta being the Aramaic version of the New Testament, and the Old Testament for that matter. How did it survive? Why was it cut off from the mainstream history of the Western church for so long? And how did it come back into connection? And then we'll take a look at the Peshitta text compared to the King James text and look at the differences. And you've already got three sheets there that you can read between now and then. Bring them back with you. But I've got a lot more examples that we'll go through, you know, here in this text. And we'll read through it in our versions and then read it in the Peshitta and see how those poor translators, doing the best they could with the tools that they had, could have made simple copy errors, just not from not knowing the understanding of the language. That changes everything. Difficult passages that seem, once again, to chip away at God as Jesus is showing him to us, resolve themselves. So we'll take that next.
Awesome.
So that's your teaser for
so good.
Catherine, would you like to lead us out in prayer? Would that be all right?